today: Racism in America, how the hateful ideology of white supremacy spread. Before we start, I want to warn you that this episode includes descriptions of racism and violence and strong language.
I'm 46. I have two children that are adults. I have three grandchildren, and I'm from originally Memphis, Tennessee.
This is Demetria Hester, who made a decision 6 years ago to move her family more than 2,000 miles across America, from the south to a city close to the west coast in the state of Oregon.
I came up to Portland to have a better life with my children. I left my husband. In Memphis, Tennessee, was so much racism, and I didn't want my children to grow up with such violence and suppression. Beknownst to me that Portland was the same kind of way. It's just more of an undercover hatred of Black people.
You're about to hear what happened to Demetria on a train in Portland just over 3 years ago at the hands of a white supremacist, and about the events that unfolded in the aftermath, all the way up to a court case this year. But this isn't just the story of one assailant, his victims, and the people who stood up to him. It's a story of a hateful ideology that has infected parts of American society with enablers that many feel include the president himself. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, the rise of white supremacist extremism in America. Demetria, can you take me back to the 25th of May, 2017, to that evening? Tell me what you were doing.
I am a professional chef, and at the time I worked a 12-hour shift, and I had a 2-hour train ride and bus ride to my house. I was on the train securely seated, one passenger seat behind the conductor, and about two stops, that's when Jeremy Christian got on ranting and raving how he was a Nazi and how he hated everyone that wasn't white and he would kill us because we were Black and that this was his country. He was giving a hate speech walking up and down the train.
What did he look like and how did you feel?
He's about 6'2", about 280, white. At the time, he had long hair and he just looked hateful. I always notice things because I'm traveling at night and I'm a woman. So I noticed immediately by his hate and his voice, I just knew what he was saying and what he was about. And then I expressed to him that we did not pay for him to verbally attack us and we have a right to be on here and not be subject to what he's saying. And he said, "Fuck you, bitch. I'll kill you. This is my train. You're not even American. You're not from here. You need to go back to your country." The conductor did nothing. I was knocking on his door the entire time that I was verbally assaulted and threatened by Jeremy Christian to take my life because I wasn't white. And no one on the train did anything or even reacted. And I was terrified because I've been on the train so many times where the conductor just stops at the next platform. And for this conductor to just keep going and letting this man keep this spewing going on was just, it was unbelievable.
Nobody did anything. Nobody.
Nobody.
You must have looked around. What were people doing?
They were occupied by listening to their radio. They had their heads down or they just ignored what was going on.
And, you know, it's quite hard to put myself in your shoes, but if I could imagine it, I think I would feel absolutely terrified. And it's an incredibly brave thing for you to do, to turn around and confront him. What made you decide to do that?
I'm from Memphis, Tennessee. You're not just going to tell me. You definitely not going to tell me what to do and what to say. So he thought that I was going to be intimidated, and I definitely wasn't. I had my mace in my hand the whole entire time.
You always carry mace?
I always carry mace, and I always carry a knife also.
Why?
Because I'm a woman, and I'm a Black woman, and I'm traveling at night. And men have a tendency to try to take advantage of women. So, no.
Have you ever had to use them before?
No. No. I've been living here this long and never had to. And I always carry it. Always. Both of them.
So you've got this gripped in your hand. I've got this man ranting and raving, racist abuse at you. Nobody's doing anything. You're banging on the door and the conductor's just ignoring you.
Yes, absolutely.
How did you feel?
Bullshit. This is some straight bullshit. I'm like, I work 12 hours. My phone is dead. The thing I was thinking was if I did pull out my knife and I kill him, that I would go to jail for the rest of my life because I was Black and he was white. And it didn't matter what he was saying or what he was doing. Reality of America is that it doesn't matter what a white person does to a Black person.
I can't believe that was going through your mind.
Yeah, that was reality. I know how to protect myself, but if I use excessive force on this white man that is verbally attacking me, threatening to kill me, I would be the one going to jail, not him. And that's facts.
And you're thinking about your babies and your grandchildren.
Yes, absolutely. I'm thinking about my kids, my safety, my life.
What happened when you got to your stop?
Jeremy Christian got out first, and when he got off, he went and put his bag down and he was looking for something in his bag. So I got off the max and had my mace in my hand. He also had the Gatorade bottle filled with wine in his hand the whole time that he was speaking, and I was watching, you know, what he was doing. And so when I saw that he had the bottle in his hand and he was about to throw it at me, I just maced him, and he threw the bottle and hit me in my right eye.
What happened to him?
So he went to the water fountain and actually was washing out his face adjacent to where I was when I had to go catch my other train. So I could visibly see him washing out the mace that I maced him with while my eye was bleeding.
Your eye was bleeding?
Oh, yeah. It was horrible. It took my eye 4 months to heal from that.
Did anyone intervene at this point?
No, because there are two TriMet supervisors who watched the whole incident happen, and their policy is that they can't intervene.
What about other people who are watching?
Exactly. Nobody did anything.
Surely the police must have turned up at this point. What did they do?
So when the officer approached me, he asked me for my ID.
He asked you for your ID?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
That's what I said. Why are you asking me for my ID? And he said, because I want to make sure you who you are. I said, while my assailant is washing out his eye from the mace that I maced him.
And what did they say?
He said, who? And so the TriMet supervisor said, that guy right there, because they witnessed it. And that TriMet supervisor was not white. He was of another ethnicity. But the officer yelled at him and said, let her tell the story. I was like, wow. Then I pointed again with the supervisor and said, that's the guy who attacked me. And he said, no, I asked him. And he said that he had nothing to do with it. And we both looked at each other like, what the fuck? And so the white TriMet supervisor says, yes, that's the guy. And he talks to him like on the side. And me and the other supervisor looking at each other like, what's going on right now?
Did it feel to you? It sounds like it to me from the way you're telling
the
story.
Absolutely.
Did it feel to you like he took the white supervisor aside because he was going to believe the white supervisor rather than you?
Of course.
And or the other BAME supervisor.
Right. Not just that, but why would you need somebody to let you know of your color that what I was saying is true? Like, why would you need that?
What happened after that on the night you're talking about?
So after he talked to me and he got my name, the assailant was finished washing out the mace and he literally walked away.
When he walked away, what did the police do?
It was crazy because he said he couldn't go and pursue him because he was alone. Right then, another car came and zoop, zoop with the lights. And so he went and he came back and said, yeah, he got away. I said, yeah, thanks. I feel really safe now. You just let him walk away. Now he's going to go and kill someone because he's spewing hate.
Did you say that?
Absolutely. And he just looked at me as if, you know, so what?
And did they write up a report?
He did write a report, but in the report, he did not put that it was a hate crime. He put it as a misdemeanor.
What did you feel like when you got home?
Okay, so TriMet sent me home after this horrible incident on a 40-seat bus by myself.
They just sent you on the bus?
A whole bus, 40-seat bus.
And what did you feel like in that journey?
I felt like I was back in 1960. Like, are you serious?
Did you cry that night?
Oh, did I? I cried for the simple fact that this is America. I shouldn't have had to think about the fact that I want to protect my life, but I had to think about the color of our skins in order to think about if I wanted to do that or not. And that's horrifying.
Well, I'm really sorry that happened to you.
Thank you.
Where were you the next day? When did you hear what he had gone on to do?
I was at home, but I was working two jobs at the time. I had to call them and let them know that I wasn't able to come to work and why. When I messaged her, she called me and she said, you might want to turn on the TV and see if this is the same guy who attacked you. And I turned on the TV and it was.
What had he done?
He had killed two people and stabbed another person. And it showed him saying he was looking for me.
What do you mean it showed him saying that?
They have footage where he actually was looking for me on the green line that I was taking the night before. So they have footage of him saying that he was looking for the bitch that maced him. That's what his words were. So he couldn't get me, so he verbally attacked two young ladies because they were African-American and a Muslim.
One of them was wearing a hijab.
Yes, she was. Mm-hmm. And three white men stepped up to protect these young ladies. They were just children. They wasn't even adults. When they even said anything to him, he wanted a confrontation and he went directly for the kill on both of the victims. And then the only reason the other victim did not die is because he cut it in a different way.
What do we know about the people who were attacked?
Talesian, he died on the scene. Ricky Best, he died on the scene. Micah Fletcher, he was hospitalized and he will be impacted his whole life because his neck has a scar that's as long as his neck and he sees it every day when he looks in the mirror. So,
how did you feel, Demetria?
I felt so horrible for the fact that they let him get away to attack and then to find out that he has been a racist, white supremacist his whole life and the police have known that and they uphold him in the wrong that he was doing. That's what's more disturbing than anything.
Can you describe what it was like to go in and give evidence?
The whole system is a joke. What they take you through is a joke. You just get victimized over and over and over again. You have to come and sit in front of the person who attacked you, and they're blatantly looking at you, trying to intimidate you. He even winked at me during the trial. The police officers was like, no, he was winking at his mom. I mean, every excuse, every leeway. And it was just so disturbing to the point where I almost threw up when I was at court. He verbally attacked me and he lunged at me. They did not have him shackled or handcuffed.
Must have been terrifying.
Oh, no, it wasn't terrifying. It was the system. It was letting me know how the judge is for Mr. Christian, not myself. In her statement, she says that she cared for him and that he was creative.
Mr. Christian, I believe that you are a creative, thoughtful person, intelligent, that you desire to learn and grow. The idiosyncratic beliefs that Mr. Scholl and the evaluator describe, unfortunately, are so rigid, and the role of the provocateur ends up manifesting itself in much more than idiosyncratic beliefs. I care about you and your well-being. I really do. And I do hope you continue to write, learn, and grow. I know that you will do that.
Oh, my God. It's so many things that's disturbing about this case.
Tell me how you felt when he was found guilty, and tell me about the sentence.
When he was found guilty, I felt some kind of satisfaction for our community. Those 12 people that said he was guilty on every account made it possible for him not to get out again. The Portland community did that.
And you expressed that sentiment outside the court that day.
This gave us hope. Say that, yes, there's actually people out there that don't want this to happen and want it to stop. And being 12 unanimous votes, that let us know that it's time for a change for our queens, our kings, everybody that wants to get from A to B. Everybody. Black lives do matter.
Lois Beckett, as a senior reporter at Guardian US, you've been reporting about white supremacy in the country. We've just heard a terrible story. And it would be comforting to think that this was a one-off incident. But I know it absolutely was not. Just this month, Donald Trump's own Department for Homeland Security said that of all extremists in the US, white supremacists pose the most persistent and lethal threat. And it's not like Jeremy Christian had these views in isolation. He was reading the same ideology all over the internet and even attending rallies. Tell me how you started reporting on all of this.
I started covering white nationalists and white supremacist organizing in 2017 after Trump was elected. Before that, I had spent several years covering the gun control debate in America. And what really shocked me as a white woman coming to this subject area was that I think I, growing up white in America, had always thought that neo-Nazis and Klan members were somehow much more racist than everyone else, that their beliefs were really extreme and beyond the pale. And when I started going to neo-Nazi rallies in Kentucky or interviewing young white nationalists in a coffee shop in Washington, D.C., what was really striking was how mainstream the actual policy views of these groups were. One thing that a lot of white Americans don't like to grapple with is how recently our country was explicitly, under law, a white supremacist one. But until the civil rights movement, which is still very much in the lifetimes of many Americans, in the lifetime of my mom, for example, many Black Americans could not vote, that there was explicit racial segregation, immigration laws that allowed larger numbers of non-white people to come to the United States. That only dates back to 1965. when I asked neo-Nazis, you know, why are you getting involved in this organizing? Your views are repulsive to the majority of Americans. What these guys would tell me is that, yeah, people don't like to say these things aloud, but look where most white Americans live. Look at the schools where white Americans send their children. In reality, the United States is still an incredibly segregated country, and white Americans, white parents, have fought extremely hard against real integration of American public schools. So I went into this thinking that these groups were fringe, as I think a lot of white Americans want to do. And what I found was that one of the things that makes white supremacists most energized and most confident that they actually could succeed in carrying out this horrific vision of having a white ethnostate is that they feel that most Americans, in the ways that they live, if not in the words that come out of their mouths, already actually agree with them.
That is shocking. How would you define white supremacy?
I think a lot of Americans, a lot of white Americans, have tried to define white supremacy as hatred towards other people, hatred of people who aren't white. But at the center of white supremacy is this idea of white power, that white should be in control of the United States, that this is a country by and for white people. And this idea of white power is about who's in control of the government, about who has the power to vote, about who has the power to carry a gun. It's about who truly is a citizen of this country. And who is not?
We recently did an episode on the QAnon conspiracy theory. And one thing that was striking was that white supremacy wasn't just being driven by anti-Black sentiment, but by hatred of so many groups, including Jewish people, with age-old tropes about their secret influence on the world. Tell me what sort of people are attracted to these explicitly racist groups.
But if you look at white supremacist organizing in the United States decade after decade, often it's men with Ivy League degrees from wealthy families who found some of the most prominent white supremacist and neo-Nazi groups. Richard Spencer, the most famous white nationalist of the current era, he went to UVA and got a graduate degree from the University of Chicago, is from a tremendously wealthy family. So it is not for the poor and ignorant. It is for everyone.
And is it legal to be part of one of these groups?
It absolutely is. The First Amendment in the United States, our emphasis on freedom of speech, means that being a neo-Nazi in public is totally legal. Committing acts of violence is not. But if you want to be a Holocaust denier or a neo-Nazi in the United States, unlike in Europe, that's totally legal.
If this is the most lethal terror threat in the US right now, how many people have been killed or injured?
So last year, 2019, which was one of the deadliest years for violent extremism since the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing, which killed 168 people, including many children, about 40 people were killed in white supremacist attacks. So looking at the broader picture of violence in America, where 15,000 people die in gun homicides every year, where 1,000 Americans annually are shot to death by the police, the number of people killed in explicitly white supremacist attacks is small. But the point of terrorism is that it ripples out and it has an impact far beyond the numbers. So dozens of people are dying, but tens of millions of Americans feel unsafe, feel unwelcome and threatened, and know that that violence is a message to them that they are not welcome, that they are not considered a true part of their own country.
We'll come to what's happening right now in 2020. But has something happened over recent decades that has led to this becoming an increasing problem?
What we're seeing now in America, there are two factors that experts consider really significant. One is the changing demographics of the United States. The idea that the United States, which was long a white majority country and which is now still 60% non-Hispanic white, will in the next few decades, by around 2045, be quote unquote minority majority. That white Americans will not have numerical control of the country. And if you look at surveys, a lot of white Americans are very unsettled by this. This is not a fringe view, but about half of white Americans think that the idea that the United States will not be majority white will be in some way bad for the culture, bad for the country. The second big factor was obviously the election of America's first Black president and the explicit racism that that drew out. And obviously, Donald Trump, as we know, was one of the most prominent people to endorse this racist conspiracy theory that Barack Obama wasn't really an American, that his birth certificate was fake, that he was secretly a Muslim.
Well, I've been told very recently, Anderson, that the birth certificate is missing. I've been told that it's not there and it doesn't exist. And if that's the case, that's a big problem. I just heard that 2 days ago from somebody.
All of these things that are so fundamentally racist and so fundamentally centered on the idea that a Black man is not really an American, cannot really be a citizen or a leader. We saw, as Obama was elected, an increasing concern from analysts at the Department of Homeland Security that the election of the first Black president would spark a new rise in white power and white supremacist movements and in violent movements, and that they would recruit military veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan in particular as part of this violence. At the time that report was made public, Republicans denounced it, veterans groups said this was a slur, but what we've seen over the past years is that absolutely was the case. What we also saw during Obama's presidency and the beginning of Trump's candidacy is a rise in social media that white supremacist groups absolutely took advantage of, and a rise in very young and smart and digitally savvy racists who knew how to use irony and humor and memes and the language of the internet to advance the causes of racism while having plausible deniability. And what we also saw were social media companies who were creating tools to build community and to help people organize and were absolutely not interested in kicking racists off their platform. When I talked to neo-Nazis from earlier decades, they would talk about their moment of discovery being finding a racist book at the library or getting a pamphlet talking about white people being oppressed and how excited they were to be recognized and validated. But now they can join Facebook groups with hundreds or thousands of people that are very active, that are very affirming, and find a real community to support those beliefs.
I can see how this also must normalize extreme views to people who are seeing it increasingly in their feeds, probably in an amplified way because of the way that algorithms work. And it's quite easy to dismiss this as a problem online. But when you think through violent events involving white supremacists, so often they come directly from social media. The neo-Nazi rally in Charlottesville, Virginia was advertised as a Facebook event. In Kenosha, there was a call out from a militia group, the Kenosha Guard, on that same site, urging patriots to defend their city. And what also stands out is the reaction of the president to these events. How much is Trump a part of this issue?
Repeatedly, after acts of white supremacist violence, most famously in Charlottesville, Trump has refused to condemn white supremacists unilaterally and say, racist violence has no place here, without also saying that there are very violent people on both sides.
You had a group on one side that was bad, and you had a group on the other side that was also very violent.
Without suggesting that not just neo-Nazis perhaps are bad, but the people who showed up to fight neo-Nazis also were bad. Over the past few months, as the United States has seen a historic uprising against racial and police violence in this country, millions of Americans turning out in support of Black Lives Matter, concerned at the repeated pattern of police killing unarmed Black Americans, Donald Trump and his administration have responded by creating a boogeyman of quote-unquote Antifa or anti-fascist groups and claiming that Antifa are domestic terrorists, suggesting that there's an organized national conspiracy of leftists trying to undermine and create unrest in America, rather than the reality that there are millions of Americans who are very upset and angry and do recognize that Black Americans face violence and targeting from the state that is unacceptable.
And this issue has come up during the presidential debates. In the first one, the moderator, Chris Wallace, asked him about it directly.
When he was asked to condemn white supremacists, Trump said, oh, who am I condemning? Suggestion was the Proud Boys. And what Trump said to the Proud Boys, which were an extremely dangerous neo-fascist group known for political street violence, he said, Proud Boys, stand back and stand by.
But I'll tell you what.
And immediately said, but, you know, the left is also a problem. Somebody has to do something about Antifa.
This is a left-wing problem.
And the Proud Boys immediately responded to Trump's message with incredible delight by saying, yes, sir, we're ready, we're standing by. They made T-shirts on them that said, stand back and stand by. They clearly saw this not as a condemnation, but as an endorsement.
Right, and in the second debate, there was this weird moment when Trump looked at the camera and claimed,
I don't care who's in the audience, I'm the least racist person in this room.
To which Biden hit back that he had enabled racism and white supremacy right from the start, from coming down the escalator talking about Mexican rapists to the Muslim ban, and as you say, to his comments about the Proud Boys, stand back and stand by. How does he justify that language?
One of the primary differences between Donald Trump and the explicit white supremacist groups that we're talking about is that they are proud of being racist. They are proud of saying that they like to racially discriminate and just like white people. Donald Trump, I think, probably sincerely believes he is not a racist. And one of the things that is so distinctive about Trump and the Americans who have rallied behind them is that they are people who express explicit desire for racist policies, whether that is very violent policing that will disproportionately target Black Americans, or a ban on Muslims entering the country, or to build a wall between the United States and Mexico. These things that are so obviously and clearly about defending the idea of America as a white country. But they don't think about themselves as a racist. They don't want to be called racist. They don't think of themselves as haters. And they will deny vociferously that any of these policies, which have clear racist outcomes, are actually about race.
I mean, you've covered gun control for years. Have you found that applies there as well?
A lot of the gun debate looks really confusing to people outside the United States. Why does America not want to pass stricter gun control laws when so many Americans are lost to gun violence? But historians are increasingly recognizing how much gun ownership is a mark of white citizenship and white power. So that's how we see in police shootings in particular, incident after incident, Black Americans say that they aren't treated as armed citizens. They aren't treated as the good guy with the gun. That the assumption is that a Black citizen with a gun is a criminal.
It's so interesting that you say that, because one of the things that Demetria said to us that really hit hard was that at the moment she was considering what to do about this man who was abusing her and about to assault her, she knew that she shouldn't use a knife against him, because if she did, that as a Black woman, she was going to suffer much worse as a result of that, and not then see her children and her grandchildren. In fact, throughout her story, it was as if race played a significant role at every turn. To what extent has that been enabled by the national political narrative?
Donald Trump likes to say he's the least racist president there has ever been. And sometimes people respond by saying Donald Trump is the most racist president. But a lot of people who think about this carefully say that the most accurate way to put it is that Donald Trump is just most explicit about his racism, that his views and the policies he supported are not that different from other presidents and certainly have a wide constituency in the United States. And what Donald Trump is willing to do is not just say racist things explicitly, but make explicit the violence and the threat inherent in all of these conflicts in the United States. Fundamentally, what's at stake here is who's allowed to be safe in the United States and who is implicitly allowed to use violence to protect their sense of safety. And what's striking about Demetria's story is how much it resonates with the experience of so many other Americans who want, like everyone else, to be safe, but know that they don't have the same resources for safety that white Americans might do, that there really isn't the same access to equal protection under the law. That's been promised to all Americans.
Coming up, what Demetria did next. Demetria, I know that you have gone on to do great things since that terrible experience, from the incident that you faced through the murders to the trial. This has been the year of the Black Lives Matter movement rising, and particularly so in Portland, where protests ran for months and months. I know that you've been at the heart of them as a really inspiring activist. Tell me what you helped to create.
We created the Moms United for Black Lives so that the moms who really wanted to come out and support Black Lives could do that. And it's successful. It has 11,000 members. And we have a California chapter, a Brooklyn chapter, and a Pennsylvania chapter so that we could go harder with the Black Lives Matter and let everybody know that that's what's going on. 24/7, 365, it's Black Lives Matter.
We've also been talking about Donald Trump, about his rhetoric and how it can fuel white supremacy, about what he said about the Proud Boys. He also sent federal officers to Portland, as we've discussed before on this podcast, and you yourself were arrested when protesting peacefully. How would you feel if he was re-elected for another 4 years?
Oh, I'm definitely leaving the United States. I'm moving to Africa. I'm not going to stay here.
Where in Africa?
Ghana.
You're planning to move to Ghana?
Yes, absolutely. I was going to move there as soon as the trial ended with Jeremy Christian, but the corona came and now we're not allowed to go. So I just feel like as Black people, we need to be liberated and we need our restitution.
How will you feel if Trump loses?
I still feel like the United States is lost because it's still a white man that's going to be telling you what to do. I can't lie to myself and say that a white man is going to make it better when that's a lie. And I really think what America needs is two Black women, one Black woman as a president and another Black woman as a vice president.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're so welcome.
That was Demetria Hester and Lois Beckett. When talking about the night she was assaulted, Demetria made certain claims that groups have responded to in the past, so we dug out some statements. Responding to her description of the conductor on the train not responding when she knocked on the door, TriMet said that the individual had immediately contacted the Operation Command Centre and a supervisor was dispatched to meet the train. Portland police have also issued a statement denying that their officer only believed the story of the white supervisor, saying they spoke to Demetria twice and there was some confusion about the identity of the suspect, which they were trying to clarify. Demetria is currently part of a caravan of activists making their way to Washington, D.C., ready for election night next week. We will be trying to check in with her along the way. Do look up Lois's excellent reporting on the rise of white supremacy at theguardian.com. You can also read her reporting on this election and that of her colleagues across Guardian US. Yesterday was also a huge day for British politics after Labour suspended its former leader, Jeremy Corbyn, because of his response to a report from the Equality and Human Rights Commission. It found that the Labour Party broke equalities law, including harassment and discrimination over anti-Semitism in the party. Keir Starmer called it a day of shame for the party and suspended Corbyn after he expressed regrets but suggested that the issue had been overstated for political reasons. Do read the reporting of our Westminster team, including our deputy political editor, Jessica Elgott. That's it for today. My thanks to Demetria and Lois. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cucutier, who is going to have a little surprise for us next week. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. Now take a deep breath, enjoy your weekend, and get ready for next week's big event. We will be back on Monday with a full week of 2020 election coverage. Take care.